to the Reason TV talk show. Let's talk about foreign policy. What, David, you were an outspoken advocate for regime change in Iraq, Iran, Syria, I believe certain parts of the United States as well. What are your fears of an Obama foreign policy?
My fears, they've got immediate fears and long-term. The immediate fears are that he's going to walk away from Iraq too fast without regard for what he leaves behind. My second immediate fear is that he may overinvest in Afghanistan, where I am very pessimistic that the United States can achieve any goals beyond minimal security goals. I worry a great deal that he will neglect the emerging alliance with India in pursuit of unworkable arrangements with Pakistan, and I worry that he will listen too much often to what countries say, not understanding that they have other ways of communicating what they really feel.
Where does Iran fit into this?
I think with Iran, actually, I think he's on basically, after a lot of stumbles at the beginning, is on the right track, which is, I have never been an advocate, and Richard and I in our book on the subject explicitly disavowed a military approach to the Iranian problem. I don't think it can work. It's important, however, not to reward bad behavior. And so certainly offer a negotiation with the Iranian state. Let them say no, which they probably will, but don't do it until after this summer's presidential elections, until after Iran has put forward a more acceptable negotiating partner. That the behavior they've engaged in has to be seen to be counterproductive by the Iranians themselves.
What, Steve, what's your hopes, fears for an Obama foreign policy?
Well, strangely, I agree with David on a lot of fronts. I think one of the things
got you in here because we thought
we thought you were some commie lefty.
David read my blog before and stole my lines. But right. I think one of the things Obama's been doing, which was disconcerting, is characterizing Iraq as the bad war and Afghanistan as the good war. And that can be a slippery slope to something where the hopes and dreams of this administration are lost very, very quickly as we gamble. We're not able to disengage responsibly the other part of it, which I think is more critical, is Obama clearly in this team of rival concept that brought a lot of people who not only see the world differently who are going to be on his team, but who all think they have the same job portfolio. You may have people who agree who are going to be struggling for the levers of power and the levers of what they're doing, and he's created a system that depends too heavily on him to be able to direct what they're doing. This is dangerous. It's very Jimmy Carter-like. And it, you know,
do you
leads
think he'll be asking his daughters about the foreign policy questions?
this is a serious problem.
Should I wear the red tie or the blue tie?
I wrote once, I said, you know, Obama could learn a lot from Dick Cheney. Because in the Bush administration, nobody knew how George W. Bush made his decision. Maybe David did. I didn't. He was inconsistent. He would go, you know, Colin Powell mattered when he was in the room and not when he wasn't. Right. Condi had six followers. But everybody knew how Cheney approached a problem. And he moved his people into positions, and he didn't have to send snowflake memos. People understood what the Cheney approach to the world would be. Nobody understands Obamaism in a way that works in a public policy environment. And in foreign policy and national security issues, I think it's vital for them to be able to identify one or two, maybe even three, Nixon goes to China moments to try to get strategic shift for the country. And all of them are high risk. And what they need is a kind of Kissingerian style secret diplomacy where you try and shield off the cost of that.
I want secrecy in that area.
I do because I think the world needs to shift into a different phase, and the United States needs to show that it can achieve its objectives again.
Very quickly give a grade, C to F for the Bush foreign policy.
D minus.
Yeah. Okay. What would you give in the end? Bush's foreign policy, yes or no?
I don't think that's a good way to think about it, because I don't think we know the answers. And
in 30 years, I mean, do we look back now and say Vietnam was the right place?
I'll give you a classic example, one I've talked about a lot with military people who served in these places. My father-in-law served in Korea. And for a decade after the Korean War, it looked like a colossal mistake. We got a lot of people killed, and Korea remained a dirt-poor country for a decade afterwards. It remained a non-democratic country for a third of a century afterwards. Today, it looks like a very good idea. It looks like something that preserved the security of Northeast Asia, put the whole of Asia on the path toward better kind of development. So I would say on the Bush foreign policy, I don't want to be like Saturday Night Live sketch of Ann Coulter asking for 500 years. But let's give it seven more.
Let me just
and
say
at the end
David,
of 7 years, let's do an assessment of Iraq and see what it's
I
like.
I will be glad to meet David in 7 years for this. But let me just say, for the near term, superpowers deploy themselves in the world militarily, economically, and morally. Militarily, we showed limits. The biggest cost to showing our limits militarily are not our foes moving. It's the fact that our allies don't count on us as much, don't believe in it as much. Economically, we just injected toxic financial products intravenously into the global financial system. We were supposed to be the kings of capitalism, you know, the ones who could do it better. We cannot drive economic behavior and browbeat the world on that front anymore in the way we used to be able to. Morally, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, it's going to take a long time for the world to forget those. So when you look at that and you look at, you know, the levers that George Bush do, the things he could do, certainly he did some great, you know, he wanted to be about tax cuts and faith-based initiatives in America. And he was hijacked, as Obama's administration will largely be hijacked, by events that he couldn't control. But when you look at how the United States is placed with military capacity, moral capacity in the world, and economic capacity, I think that whether or not you were here 7 years or not, those were things where decisions could have made that didn't undermine the mystique of this country.
I want to say two more words on the Bush foreign policy, and they are Latin America. That when George Bush came to office, the United States faced a flaming insurgency in Colombia. It faced great question marks about the durability of Mexican democracy, and it had this this thug ruler in Venezuela who was trying to goad the United States into building up his power by making the same mistakes that Kennedy and others made with Castro in the 1960s. The Bush foreign policy helped to rescue Colombia. It helped to stabilize Mexico, and it avoided after they had one bad day in Venezuela, but generally they avoided taking the bait. And what we now have are a series of stable left-of-center democracies in places like Chile and Brazil, with which a right-of-center government in the United States has had productive relationship, showing we have state-to-state relationships that don't depend on who the party in power is. We have hope that Latin America is breaking out of its boom and bust political cycle, and that is a great achievement. And Americans,
so how much of that is Clinton? Clinton is the one who started Plan Colombia, which, by the way, I actually think was a perversion of American foreign policy based on idiotic drug laws. What's the Bush add-on to that?
In 2001 and 2002, the Democratic Party was ready to give up on Colombia. Mm-hmm. Plan Colombia was once massively controversial. Free trade agreements with Colombia remained stalled. Bush shepherded through to success. It's a little bit like India, that Clinton initiated it, but it was Bush who took the policy to its conclusion, often over the opposition of Clinton's own party that had only grudgingly gone along with it under Clinton, taking the partnership with India into a true security alliance, or the beginnings of a true security alliance.
What's really interesting with this conversation, I spent part of the day yesterday watching the inaugural parade with Newt Gingrich, and Newt is extremely worried about stability in Mexico, thinks that we've neglected Mexico, that Mexico is about to become a raging failure, and that there could be systemic collapse of the political order.
Why should we be taking seriously anything that Newt Gingrich is talking about?
Well, I just find it interesting because he is sort of a colleague of David's.
And that they're both smart, and
you can look at the same political system. And I sort of agree with Newt that from the one perspective, that we're not paying enough attention, in my view, to Mexico, the drug wars, the border wars, the things that are going on down there right now, and what Newt is making an appeal for is sort of, you know, serious journalists and experts to sort of get back and sort of look there, because he feels like it's neglected. But I find it interesting not that David looked at that as a success story, whereas I think it's a bit of a suspect case right now.
Steve, what are your hopes for Obama making enormous changes in American foreign policy? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, when Iraq was the big issue and people were rallying around Obama and saying, you know, this sort of code pink type thing, where the second you get into office, you're going to pull all those people out of the Middle East and bring them back. And then, of course, that was supplanted by questions of the economy. So now, I mean, there are a lot of people. Gabe Schoenfeld had an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day. Eli Lake, who's been a guest on this show, had an interesting piece in the New Republic, making the argument that there is something sort of fundamentally neoconservative about Obama's foreign policy. And I do you agree with that?
No,
he's
hawkish on certain values, and I think Hillary Clinton will talk about a values-based foreign policy. But the decision to keep Bob Gates in place and allow Jim Jones to play the NSC advisor, combined with the other team from Hillary Clinton, in my view, is a very interesting effort to try to pull off these Nixon goes to China moments, to have good cops, bad cops. He's playing. He knows he has to play a complex chess game with other global players.
But are you disappointed? I mean, he was the peace candidate. Are you? I mean, is he backtracking from that immediately?
I don't believe in peace. I believe in equilibrium, and I want a new equilibrium. Right now, we have a world without a stable equilibrium in a lot of these regions. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to be smart and figure out how you can achieve, how can you get American power back? One of the things you do is you don't throw yourself
What is the linkage at this point in time between the war in Iraq and the war on terror? Or what is Obama going to bring to, is there a war on terrorism that needs to be fought?
I happen to hate the concept of war on terror. Mm-hmm. I don't think it does us any good to sort of create a basket of problems that makes us intellectually lazy into thinking how you deal with the tribal areas in Pakistan, how do you deal with Hamas and Hezbollah, which I think have different characteristics. How do you go through with something where the world is far more complex and there is no one-size-fits-all and the demands on the United States are enormous?
In the way that the war on terror affects domestic policy, whether it's airport security or whether it's immigration policy and things like that, what is Obama going to do?
Well,
is it going to change anything, David? Are we in code orange forever and ever?
Yes. All of those policies, I think, will probably remain and only get worse because of the classic problem of bureaucratic incentives, mm-hmm. right? If you ever relax anything that seems silly and then anything bad mm-hmm. happens, you're responsible for it. The concept of a war on terror is a useful and powerful concept for two reasons, because it protects us from two mistakes that we have often made in the past. The first is thinking the purpose of counterterrorism policy is to produce arrests and convictions rather than to prevent future terrorist attacks. And the second is that it reminds us to look forward to national security rather than to look backward to punishing wrongdoers. Mm-hmm. The point to the military concept was not that law enforcement is weak and military is strong. It's that military action is forward-looking and law enforcement is necessarily backward-looking. Mm-hmm.
But you do see the downside of the war on terror as a concept. It does create laziness in the sense of how you actually put together a results-driven strategy mm-hmm. to deal with the component pieces of this is what I find alarming. And a high-fear national security state that doesn't know how to unwind itself around is a problem.
People can be lazy under almost any framework. And people can be stupid under almost any framework. But what you need to tell bureaucracies is, what are you here to achieve? Are you here to punish past terrorists, or are you here to prevent future acts of terrorism?
It would be, I mean, just as a starting point, it would be interesting, and, you know, obviously there are state secrets, but to have any sense that that's what's going on in the American government, because I don't think that that is communicated. This is one of the things about the Bush administration. Among its other failings, it failed to communicate virtually any activity that it was doing that might have been popular or successful.
And this is one of the things that came back to Obama's speech, which I thought was one of the most memorable and powerful parts of that, is that many people began to believe that the war on terror justified a rollback of civil liberties and rights in the country. And Obama said squarely, it's a false choice. We can have security and maintain our values.
That's BS. Administration, they were working towards all of those goals.
Public
mind, it's important.
How much trust do you put in that little, which I think will amount to a throwaway line in the speech and a great rebuke to the president that is sitting right behind him?
Right.
When you have, as we were discussing the other day, a head of the CIA that was deeply involved in rendition in the 1990s. Is anything going to really?
It's
really,
all cosmetic.
When people talk about the infringements on civil liberties and rights allegedly or supposedly took place in the Bush years, they talk about that as if there's some inheritance from the past that was diminished. On the contrary, what we saw in the 1990s was a huge new assertion of a claim that law should govern the national security, the external mm-hmm. national security functions of the state. And I recommend to everybody the opening chapters of Jack Goldsmith's book on the terror presidency. Now, Jack Goldsmith is a critic of the Bush administration, but he points out that the accusations of lawlessness that are made until like 1993, nobody would ever have imagined of these actions would govern were governed by domestic law in the first place.
I would put it first off in a broader context, and this is one of the problems with the Clinton presidency, is that when you look at something like the Communications Decency Act, and we're not talking about terror-related infringements, but it was an attempt to clamp down on the Internet, which was then a new and scary technology, and essentially to regulate it like a broadcast network. It was only the Supreme Court that got rid of that, which would have vastly diminished our contemporary social sphere or public sphere of debate and things like that.
I don't know if my blog would have survived that.
Well, no, but I mean, it wouldn't have. Not if you were talking about medical or excretory functions. And, you know, like, we can talk about your blog. I understand that that's two of its main topics. But, no, there has always been a push and pull as we get more capable of doing and living whatever we want or however we want to pull that back. And, I mean, I think the Clinton administration was a strong case of that. I think the Bush administration in various ways. And, the Supreme Court has weighed in on various kinds.
There are a number of young bloggers and young bloggers on the left that came of age and started writing during the Bush years.
Right.
And I have a feeling that in the next 8 years, they're in for a great big surprise.
Right.
And realizing that there is some sort of continuity, and what you're talking about, Jack Goldsmith's book, and talking about rendition, between Clinton-era policies and Bush-era
policies.
It's
like LBJ and Nixon.
I honestly talk to young people who believe in change, in this concept of change. And I'm obviously much more cynical about this, that everything is going to change. Iraq is going to end. Civil liberties are going to be just peachy. And no one will ever be rendered in the war on terrorism land. You know, there are people that I talk to about
and that America, Iran will suddenly love America.
Yes, yes.
What I want to see is
there was a shock when they were burning a picture of Barack Obama in Revolutionary Square.
This is a great topic, and I want to see an issue of Reason and maybe a Reason TV show. Looking at David may disagree, but in my view, how many of the usurped executive authorities that Congress sort of acquiesced to does the Obama administration give away?
Right.
I think nearly none.
Starting with the declaration of war?
Probably. But, I mean, I think that this is a serious issue. When you look at Jack Goldsmith,
they're not going to
make
away
the same thing. I was with Rahm Emanuel at one of these parties the other night. I look at Rahm and how he operates. This guy's not going to be engineering a forfeiture of executive power. And it's going to be important for Congress to come back and take back a lot of its prerogatives and privileges. But this would be a great natural for you guys.
I mean, and I think we all agree that it'll be zero. I mean, or let's put it this way, the Obama presidency is not giving up any power that it assumed yesterday. Right. Okay. David, talk a little bit about the new majority website and why you didn't call it widestance.com.
We launched on Inauguration Day, and it's a group endeavor with a number of contributors, most of them people who identify as Republicans. Others are people who I think ought to be Republicans or should be Republicans. Mm-hmm.
But what are they, though?
Homeless
people?
You get your own
We'll get to you at a
second. Working cheap is a big job requirement. But they are people who have, in many cases, government experience. We had Michael Powell and Douglas Holtz-Eakin on our first day, and other people like that. Then some people you haven't heard of. But we are trying to redefine what a relevant 21st century Republicanism is going to look like.
And what is that?
So this is your army in the next civil war, party civil war.
What I would propose is you have to have a party that has a softer, more modulated tone on social issues. That doesn't mean you change your mind. It just means you dial down.
Shut up about it?
No, you modulate it.
Social issues, gay rights.
You're in favor of abortion, or you think it should be left to the states, right?
I think that's the right compromise.
Okay.
Here's a perfect example of what I mean. That the Republican Party can be a party that is pro-life insensibility. It can be a party where there's a consensus that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided and we want judges who will overturn it and return that authority to the states. But we don't really seriously mean to pass a human life amendment to the Constitution. We've never tried to do it in all the, 29 years that it's been in the party platform. So why keep putting it in the party platform and frightening people? We need to integrate the environment into the core of our message as a party. This is a genuine change of consciousness that has happened, and I think it is there.
What does that mean?
What that means...
Teddy Roosevelt.
That means both.
Teddy Roosevelt, the great. He liked the Porsche. Especially of the dusky races.
No, he was
a, huge eticist. He was a white man's burden.
He was a big believer in large families of all kinds. And in fact, there's the famous story about. Anyway, I won't get into the bylaws of it, but that's just a slur.
Right.
That's just a slur.
He was also asthmatic, by the way.
It has implications for both national and local Republicans. On the local side, it means the Republican politician should not always be positioned as the guy who wants the highway widened and the historic downtown knocked down. At the national level, it means you have to take on board the seriousness of the climate change issue. You have to say putting all this carbon into the atmosphere is going to have effects. We can argue about how large they are, and we have to move to a post-carbon economy, but a rational one that emphasizes nuclear power and not windmills. We need an emphasis on competence and executive experience. We need to persuade our grassroots members that government is difficult and it can't be done by just anybody. And so a Harriet Myers does not belong in the Supreme Court and a Sarah Palin doesn't belong in the Oval Office. You have to do a – if you put people like that,
you
won't
do a good
job. Can
you name an incompetent Republican man, or is this just sexism?
These are the two most signal cases. Okay. We need to, we need, above all, to have a broad appeal to the people who used to be the core of the Republican Party, educated voters and younger people. Time was when the Republicans owned the vote of the university educated. That is no longer true. It is a huge problem.
And where do they come in with anybody who has a BA or above votes Democrat now?
No. This one, historically, if you had a more than 6 years of education, they disaggregate, to be technical about this.
Okay.
88 is the first year where the exit polls separate people with postgraduate from BA education. Up to 88, Republicans win the highly educated in every year except 1964.
Mm-hmm.
In 1988, we begin to see that Democrats are winning the postgrads, but Republicans are winning those with 4 to 6 years of higher education. Even in 1992, which is closer, the people with BAs, although they leave the Republicans, they go to Perot. Clinton didn't do much better on the university educated than Dukakis did. But they have been leaving and leaving and leaving.
So what
the population
explains
is getting
that?
Bigger
that you're
and
losing,
bigger and
if,
bigger.
And when did they lose? When did the Republicans have the youth vote?
1984, Reagan won first-time voters by 21 points, and he won under 30s by 20 points. And the elder Bush won both groups, but by smaller margins in 88. It hasn't happened. It hasn't happened since. Why has it changed? Well, partly it's changed because the college population is different. It's much bigger. It's poorer. It's younger because all the people who got their BAs in 1932 were still in the electorate in 1988 or 1938.
And David, there's a lot of the social issues, though. I mean, if you look at something like from 1990 when in America, if you asked people, and it was the earliest poll that I saw, about gay marriage or domestic partnerships, I mean, you're somewhere around 15 to 20%. Now that's around 50%. That's a sea change.
Social issues are a big part of the
story. What should the Republicans do about gay marriage?
But so is economics. Between 2000 and 2006, the wages of college graduates declined after inflation. I think that has a big impact on how college graduates vote. What should the Republicans do about
gay marriage? Yeah, when you talk about social issues and modulation,
Republicans should be preparing themselves for a great change in the national mind that you can visibly measure is in the process of happening. I don't think the United States, or very many of the states, will have gay marriage in the sense that they will amend their laws to include this thing. But they will have many states will have the functional equivalent, and the country will then experiment with the results and see what happens.
Think your party needs to embrace that?
You're pushing the vehicle too hard if you ask it to embrace, but what you need to do is to de-emphasize it as an issue, not make it a core part of your identity.
But that is the core identity. Everything that you've listed, this is like Democrat light. I mean,
resisting government investment in the economy, resisting overregulation, limited government. That is the core of the Republican message, and so
where does that come out of, though? Because the Bush years then, there is that question of incompetency. He's the one who nominated Harriet Myers. He's the one who blew out the budget in his first 4 years.
He added
$354 billion to the economy. In the second, it was about $270 billion. To put that in perspective, Lyndon Johnson in his 4 years added about $220 billion in inflation-adjusted terms. Kick the jams out on this stuff.
But
embrace environmentalism.
This is well, not exactly, but this is
put it at the, he finally he admitted that man-made change was happening.
And right? What did he do about it?
I don't know. But no. What is any? Nobody's doing anything about
nobody's
it.
Nobody's doing anything about
no,
it.
No, I mean, the Clintons didn't do anything about it either, and Obama won't other than build windmills.
One of the reasons that that we see this happening after 1990, that the Republicans become more of a social issues party, there are many causes internal to the Republican Party. There's an external cause, which is the Democratic Party in the after 1994 and 5 moved to the center on economic issues, and then crowded the Republican field, pushing the Republicans more toward the social right. Under Obama, the Democrats are voluntarily vacating that ground, so it is going to be there to be recaptured, and there will be room again for a Republican economic message.
But that's a libertarian economic message, which is not that government needs. It's not an anarchist thing. It's not that government is horrible or a Reaganite government is the problem, but rather that government needs to be small and competent. Right?
But what we're going to need to do in the area of health care is not going to be very libertarian, I'm afraid. We are going to have, with the government spending about one health care dollar out of every two, and that continuing indefinitely.
And with icebergs melting so we can't even push old people off on them anymore, it's going to be very complicated.
The restructuring of the health care market is, and to hold the rise in health care costs down in some other way than the way the Democrats want to do it, which is by using the monopsony power of the state, that is going to take a degree of government intervention, of shaping of this marketplace, I think that the Republicans draw on the libertarian tradition for a lot of their ideals. To the extent libertarianism is an impulse or an instinct, it's very core to where the Republican Party is. But to the extent that it becomes a highly formed ideology, it is not so helpful. And especially, if I may say to your viewers, libertarians are very prone to buy into a lot of notions that are kind of cranky and obsolete, like the gold standard, like Ron Paul and Austrian monetary economics. I mean, these things, that there is progress.
The one thing you could say about, and I'm not saying I'm a hardcore, I'm certainly, I like Ron Paul's message in the abstract.
Did you endorse Ron Paul in Reason?
No, never. We don't endorse anybody.
Yeah.
It's the one thing we can say is that neoclassical and Keynesian economics haven't worked out so well. So why not try Austrians?
On the contrary, that what we have seen over the years since World War II is that we've had much more, just as was promised, much more macroeconomic stability, fewer recessions, and milder than we had in the
days. But that's because we don't have a gold standard. We have effectively competing private or national currencies.
That's just flatly wrong, I would say. In the days of the gold standard, I mean, there are actually little graphs.
I'm not saying the gold standard was good. I think it's nonsensical in the long run. But the idea is, and the Austrian idea, the Hayekian idea, is competing currencies, which is effectively what we have in a way that we did not until relatively recently.
That's a policy idea. But the core.
Libertarian cranky ideas, sidewalks, all of that kind of stuff.
And those things are dangerous to the Republican Party. But what is helpful is this impulse, this temperament, this instinct, and that's at the core. And libertarianism, to the extent libertarianism maps to the American constitutional and historical tradition, that's where the Republican Party draws.
Well, it's a challenge to actually come up also, I think, from a Republican point of view with a positive vision of government. Because that is smaller and efficient, and it's not bureaucratic, and it's not bloated, and it's not telling you how you run your business, how you do this, how you do that, because the Republican message since Reagan and actually since Goldwater has been that government is the problem. So, I mean, it becomes very difficult without just looking like a kind of echo of the Democratic problem.
Well, with what David is doing, though, with folks like Doug Holtzeek and I think Tevye Troy and others who are very smart intellectuals who are coming to sort of struggle with this issue. I think it's impressive you're doing this. But you've got Grover Norquist also out trying to basically put together new infrastructure and figure out how do you revitalize, relaunch the Republican Party. Not that Susan Eisenhower is everyone's favorite former Republican, but she is very uncomfortable with Democrats, for instance, thinks this kind of thing needs to happen. And, of course, you're going to have a pod of folks out there that I don't think will be highly intellectual, but, want to run Palin and amass behind Palin.
Or Mike Huckabee. You've got to be anti-Huckabee, right?
I don't know I don't think Huckabee is more of a chameleon in this.
I don't believe he's going to run again.
Okay.
But I do think there's this question of how this plays out, and I'm fascinated by your use of a blog, a cluster blog, as essentially to do what some other think tanks might have done in terms of trying to revitalize and capture this.
Many of them are distributed across think tanks. Right. We want to get them talking to each other, but above all, we also want to get commenters talking, people talking to each other, because one of the things that we've all had to adjust to in the world of media is that the days where some speak and others listen are largely over. This is a conversation that comes from all vectors, and you have to draw everyone in as a participant,
right.
And that is one of the great powers.
Are you going to moderate the comments, or what do you do? Because Reason's Hit and Run blog has unmoderated comments, which is a defining characteristic, but also, people like to talk about
it. We want the comments to be civil, and we want them to be pertinent.
Right. So then you're going to be moderating.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to have your own private conversation, that's great. But here we have
something. Do it on Steve's blog.
Yeah. Here we have something we want to talk about.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about thewashingtonnote.com.
Well, the Washington Note is not a new thing. It's been around 4.5 years, and it's my own sort of daily engagement with ideas, trying to come to terms with what I myself think about issues. I mean, the world is changing. There are different players and people. I try to keep it a little gossipy. I realize, West Wing was very popular. A lot of the country want to see what's going on at David Frum's house. And as long as I don't, as long
what
as I don't,
going on at David Frum's house?
No. I mean, what I mean by that is there is a responsible way to share with Americans and others around the world.
Your incredibly busy social life?
Yeah, it's not social life, but the fact that there's policy to talk about. And that there's a way to do it responsibly, where I'm not divulging what's going on. And I think
What's that mean? So when you're in your Bilderberger meetings or something, that's walled off?
When I was at Maureen Dowd's house the other day, I was talking about, Rahm Emanuel's encounter with David Geffen and what that means for the country. Mick Warren wasn't in the room. So, but there are pieces, there are ways in which to sort of bring together an audience. I'm not a grassroots guy. I'm trying to sort of reach out, and there are a lot of senators who read the blog. There are a lot of members of Congress, people in media. And the idea is, to sort of get them to think about, what David's trying to do. Think about the inequality problem. Think about the domestic social contract. How do you frame these issues? What are the areas for opportunity? What's the risk of Barack Obama being pinpricked by all of our allies to sort of see how much, love they think America has for them? I mean, there's a chance of hijacking our foreign policy that I think is very important. And so you can move these issues into a blog, but I'm not trying to revitalize the Democrats. Right. In fact, I'm a very robust critic of of Obama and the Obama bubble on various fronts. And I'm an independent. I'm not a Democrat.
Who'd you vote for?
I voted this time for Obama reluctantly.
Who did you?
I wanted to vote
as a Democrat?
He wouldn't like. My guy was Hagel. I was very out. I like Chuck Hagel.
Right, Hagel.
Hagel's
gone.
Chuck Hagel. Hagelism.
He's a Hegelian.
Hagel. I get it where I can.
What can the Democrats do to blow it?
A lot.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot of corruption in the financial. I think they can overreact and allow their foreign policy and national security decisions to be quickly hijacked by events. I think that...
Do you worry that they'll be too hawkish or too dovish?
I don't think in those terms. I think you've got to have a mix. You've got to figure out how to give Obama and his team the space to try to get some different dynamics. But as David said, on the economic side, one of the things you run the risk of in all of these areas are vested interests building in, then you have a sort of a guaranteed system of inertia. You have that in foreign policy and national security, too. So... it's very hard to get strategic shifts.
It doesn't strike me that an Obama administration would have been much different on the situation in Gaza, for instance.
Right.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure what the Bush administration was
doing
the situation
we'll
in Gaza.
We'll see how this comes out. But I do think that the country right now, what you were talking about declinism earlier, I'm not a declinist, but I am someone who thinks in very real terms about equations of power. And what is very, very important for this administration to do is to begin achieving things it says it's going to do.
Right.
And so,
well,
it's got
to
create
coming
a modest...
back to inequality. Yeah. What do you mean by that? And then what does the government do?
I knew you were going to hit.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just asking.
Well, I think that we allowed the Bob Rubin followers and acolytes to have too much dominance and self-deal too much in the economy, and they broke. David is interesting because the piece he wrote in the New York Times magazine said Republicans are missing an opportunity to recapture and reframe how to achieve fairness for hard work and motivation in the country. What became unbalanced was a sort of triumph of the Wall Street guys, essentially, in a turbocharged, deregulated world.
Take it down from the abstract. Where,
no, it's not
an
abstract
thing. Jason Thompson in The Sound and the Fury railing against Wall Street, right?
I mean, no, so I'm railing against Bob Rubinism.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, so what does that mean, that you don't allow collateralized securities, you don't have mortgage-backed securities, you don't do this? You don't allow people to participate in the stock market and historically large figures?
There are two very moderate policy instruments you could use that would have a great effect in moderating the tremendous trend toward extremes of inequality that we've seen over the last couple of decades. One is...
But what are the extremes towards inequality where more people at every income level owned houses, and where people have more consumer goods and more access to education?
It's not a sign of wealth.
Is going to college, right?
There are numbers on this. You can see the median income stagnated in the 2000s, you can see a tremendous increase of wealth at the top, and you can also see, because of immigration, a tremendous increase of poverty at the bottom.
Among the first generation. I mean, those trends mitigate
over
time.
Well, no. That's a pure declaration of libertarian ideology. Contradicted by everybody who has actually studied the problem.
What we are
seeing is that the educational levels among second and third generation Latinos are very alarming. The illegitimacy rates are very alarming. And in fact, I shouldn't say use the term Latinos, because that covers too much ground. Mexican Americans, in particular, there's a lot.
The processes of assimilation have been attacked by Republican and Democratic.
Well,
is that by every assimilation trend, third-generation Mexican-Americans are doing better than the people who showed up here. They speak English more, they go to school longer, and they're more likely to own a house.
The pay gap between Mexican-Americans and other Americans, is contracting
very
slowly.
What do you do to fix that, then? Do you keep the Mexicans out?
You restrict immigration, and you focus your immigration on more highly skilled immigrants.
So the humanitarian goal, and Steve, would you go along with this, to end inequality is to keep the poor people out?
You have to have a healthcare policy that both makes healthcare insurance more widely affordable and slows the increase in healthcare costs, because that's the thing that is gnawing incomes at the middle. Those two things, I mean, they're not a total solution to a total problem, because I agree with you. You don't want to go to, as a conservative anyway, you are aware that inequality is the product of a lot of things that are desirable, of intensified competition, of a more global division of labor. So those are good things. But at the extreme, it becomes dangerous to people's trust and confidence in government. Mm-hmm. It becomes dangerous to Republican self-government, as every one of the founding fathers agreed. You need to moderate and modulate. There's a danger in the conservative mind. People become conservatives because they tend to be binary people. Up, down, on, off, black, white. And so whenever you say this is a problem, they say, you must therefore want to do exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's not true. I often say, look, our policy dial on this issue is set to 8. It needs to be set to 6. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying turn it off. I'm not saying change your mind. Dial some things back. Acknowledge this is a problem and say, are there limited instruments whose gains are worse, are better than the costs are real, and the costs are real, even from a policy like restricting immigration, that could solve or mitigate or or make a dent in a domestic problem. And immigration restriction and healthcare reform could make a real difference to the life chances of Americans who are born poor or middle class.
In exit polling, what is the primary concern of Republicans? Is it income inequality? Is it healthcare? I have looked at this stuff in the past, and I don't know it off the top of my head. What is the big issue that is...
In the primaries in 2008, we saw again and again immigration was given as the cause. I think there are things that exit polls are good at, and I think there are things they're bad at. And asking people what motivates their vote is never a useful question, because you have to give them a list of categories, which means you have to impose an order from the outside on the way people think.
And immigration's on there, and...
But what different people mean different things by immigration.
Immigration I think, highly overrated as a national issue. Border districts.
There are lots of things that can deal with the inequality issue. I mean, just that when I was trying
John
to think
McCain
about Bob Rubinism,
didn't lose because he wasn't conservative.
Right. No.
as far as I can tell.
Randy Graff in Arizona didn't win because he was anti-immigration. He lost.
I agree with David on health care, but there are a lot of other things that Republicans could advocate that Democrats could sign up, which I'm surprised that, you know, Bill Clinton's administration, mm-hmm. portability of pensions, portability of education.
That's happening.
Moving. It's happening. It's happening slowly. But when you look at what executives at the highest level have got, the system to provide for them and their ability to move. It's remarkable when you look at a single mother trying to make it in this economy. My colleague Karen Kornblut calls them juggler moms and juggler families, the mommy tax. There are lots of things, you know, and when I was motivated by David Crumb's piece.
Yeah, I agree.
This is very important. It's more than thinking they're soft issues. They're hard issues for people working at that level. And this system is not providing that. And we've allowed the growth and gains of the economy to go to what... Without a relatively decent level of regulation, these folks became corrupt.
We're going to have to leave it here. I think that's interesting. I agree totally that the question of whether or not people felt bought into a system of upward mobility is huge in America. And I think that many of us at the top end of the distribution are misunderstanding the way that people see their function at the lower level.
Right.
And also that most of the policies that will allow people to mobilize up are actually, it's a rescission of government, not an increase. But we're going to have to stop here. Thank you very much. This was the Reason TV Talk Show with my Nick Gillespie, with my co-host Michael C. Moynihan, and our guests were Steve Clemens of the New America Foundation and the WashingtonNote.com, and David Frum, author of Comeback and also of the website, the new website, newmajority.com. Thanks very much.